The census results are in, and we learn what that means here at home. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, April 27th, and this is In the Moment. Longtime congressional staffer Chuck Parkinson joins us this hour to unpack the origin and mission of the U.S. Census and to explain what, if anything, is changing for South Dakota after the latest count. And as part of this month's SDPB Spotlight coverage of guns in South Dakota, SDPB's Seth Tupper joins us to review the evolution of gun policy in the state. Plus, this year's Leopold Conservation winners Levi and Crystal Newharth of Prairie Paradise Farms. They join us to outline their philosophy of healthy land, healthy animals, and healthy families. But first, SDSU football, one step closer to a national championship. I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh, and you're In the Moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The South Dakota Department of Health is taking first steps in implementing the voter-approved medical marijuana law. The department is requesting proposals from vendors for a statewide patient registry, verification, and licensing system. The law goes into effect on July 1st, but the measure gives the department time to implement the program. Kim Mulsom-Risden is the health secretary. She says the system will also issue medical cards.
We need to have that in place by the end of October, and so getting the RFP out now will give us time to make sure that it's ready to go by that date. We're also working on various administrative rules that also need to be in place by the end of October, and ultimately ready to issue cards by November 18th.
During the legislative session, Governor Kristi Noem wanted to delay implementation of the medical marijuana program. Noem argued that would give the state time to study the law and give the Department of Health time to also deal with the coronavirus pandemic. That push ultimately failed. Noem wants lawmakers to consider some changes to the law in a special session, but she lacks support in the Senate. Weather officials expect droughts in South Dakota to continue through the summer. Most of the region remains dry, and meteorologists worry there might not be enough spring rain. Doug Cluck directs Midwest Climate Services for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says much of the region saw minor improvements, but many places have not changed since last year.
The Northern Plains, current conditions are pretty darn dry. They have been dry. They've been dry since fall in a lot of places, and we haven't had a lot of recovery.
Weather officials say that April, May, and June are the wettest months of the year. USDA Midwest Climate Hub Director Dennis Toddy says he's concerned that drought conditions will not improve before the summer.
The peak chances for precipitation climatologically are coming very close, and we don't see that coming along. Eastern parts of the Dakotas and further east, you know, have more chances for precipitation as the year goes on, as the growing season goes on, so they have better chances for recovery later on. But, you know, droughts like this don't shift overnight. They don't solve overnight. We need multiple events.
The U.S. Drought Monitor reports more than 90% of South Dakota is dry, with extreme drought in most of the Northwest. The National Weather Service expects the state to see colder temperatures and less precipitation for the rest of the month. South Dakota's population increase of 8.9% since 2010 ranked the 16th highest in the nation. The U.S. Census Bureau released its first round of data from a 2020 headcount. South Dakota's population increased by more than 70,000 people since 2010, bringing the total to roughly 886,000. It remained the fifth least populated state in the United States. South Dakota's growth rate outpaced neighboring states like Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota. North Dakota recorded the region's highest percentage growth of 15.8%. In South Dakota, a committee of lawmakers will determine new state legislative districts based on detailed census data set to be released later this year. For weather today, cloudy skies with showers and thunderstorms across the state. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Jackie Hendry in today for Lori Walsh. The South Dakota State University football team is one step closer to an FCS national championship. The Jackrabbits defeated the Holy Cross Crusaders 31-3 in the first round of playoffs this past Saturday. They'll go on to face the Southern Illinois Salukis this Sunday night at 8 Central Time. That's at the Dana J. Dykehouse Stadium in Brookings. Matt Zimmer covers SDSU football for Argus Leader Media, and he joins us now with more. Matt Zimmer, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what I'm hearing from fans is this Jackrabbit football team is really unlike any other that we've seen maybe in the institution's history. What seems to be making the difference for the team this season?
They've kind of taken care of business in a way that they haven't always done. And as such, they won their conference and they got to be the top seed in the playoffs, which means they'll have home field advantage through the playoffs. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's necessarily the best team they've ever had, but some of the teams they had in the past that were good enough to make it this far, you know, they just lost one or two games along the way that forced them to go on the road for the playoffs, and that just made it too difficult for them to get to their ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's probably helping them is North Dakota State isn't as good as they usually are, and they're usually the dominant team, so I think that's helped a little bit. But they've kind of put themselves in position now, you know, like I said, with home field advantage. And also another kind of fringe benefit is playing in this strange COVID season and having a bunch of games off. At one point, they had three consecutive games either canceled or rescheduled. I think that ended up, you know, being a benefit to them as much as they didn't like it, because now here they are late in the season playoffs, but very, very healthy and very fresh, and I think that's helping them too.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of it being such an odd season with the pandemic, I'm curious if you can walk us through what the season means for the eligibility for some of these athletes, assuming they continue on in such extraordinary fashion. Is there a chance we could see this team compete together again?
Yeah, they essentially only have one true senior in that only one of their players is not returning next year. And when I say next year, I mean this coming fall, because obviously it's almost like there are two 2021 seasons because right. of how this all played out with the 2020 season getting postponed. One good thing the NCAA did, and you don't get to say those words very often, but one thing they did was say, okay, because COVID has obviously sort of wreaked havoc on everyone, and you know whether you're getting your games in or not, it's been totally different because you know tournaments were canceled in 2020, playoffs were canceled, and some sports entire seasons were canceled. A lot of games have been played in front of no fans or limited fans. So to kind of try to pay back the college athletes for what they've had to endure throughout this entire pandemic is saying, okay, whether you choose to play in these, you know, pandemic altered seasons or not, it doesn't count towards your eligibility. So basically, anyone who's a junior, say, right now, will still be a junior when they come back in the fall. So you have guys that, you know, are basically all getting an extra year. And like I said, in South Dakota State's case, there's only one guy, Preston Tetzloff. They have like 10 or 12 seniors, something like that. He's the only one who's not coming back because he's, I believe, moving on to law school. So he'll be going, this will be kind of his last hurrah. But for all the other guys who are, you know, who came into the season as seniors, they will still be able to return in the fall. And that goes nationwide and it goes for all sports. So I think long-term it could create some really weird scenarios because obviously normally a freshman class comes in out of high school and, you know, there's a senior class that moves on that they can sort of replace. Well, now, you know, it could potentially get a little crowded with one class moving in and no classes moving out. And a lot of other, you know, I think, you know, we'll see for the first time ever, we'll see seventh-year seniors. It's going to be a weird thing, but I think the NCAA really didn't have much of a choice but to kind of, you know, offer this to the student athletes because of what they've been through.
Right. In our final moments together, what are we expecting for this weekend's game against Southern Illinois? How have the Jackrabbits fared against them in the past?
They beat them 44-3 about a month ago. Yeah, so it's one of those deals where you look at that and go, oh, well, this should be a blowout. This should be an easy win. But, you know, Southern Illinois did still manage to make the playoffs, and they're coming off a very big first-round playoff win against a team that had been undefeated before. Mm. So I think that throws a little bit of a wrench into it, so to speak. But also, 44-3 being what it is, I think Southern Illinois played much worse in that game than they normally would. It was one of those deals where kind of everything went right for one team and everything went wrong for the other. So that makes this a pretty intriguing matchup. Being that the Jackrabbits are at home and they're the number one seed, they should win. But anyone who assumes that because it was 44-3 the last time, it's going to be easy, I don't think it's going to play out that way.
Again, that playoff game is this Sunday night at 8 Central Time in Brookings. Matt Zimmer covers SDSU football for Argus Leader Media, and you can find more of his reporting at argusleader.com. Matt, thanks for the update, and thanks for being here.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Chuck Parkinson explains the U.S. Census results and what they mean for us here in South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Ten years ago, one of the worst tornado outbreaks in U.S. history ripped through the Deep South. More than 300 people were killed, and one of the worst-hit cities was Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
I didn't foresee us coming back, I'm just be honest with you. I thought it'd be a ghost town, not like it is now.
A decade after devastation, a check-in on recovery this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Corn and soybean farmers are having a pretty good run.
These markets are double what we could sell, I mean, not even a year ago, months ago. It's crazy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is planting season down on the farm. That is next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. The U.S. Census Bureau released its 2020 results this week. Some states have gained congressional seats, others have lost seats. But what does it mean for South Dakota? Longtime congressional staff member Chuck Parkinson is here to put it in perspective. Chuck Parkinson, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jackie. It's good to be with you.
So before we get to those local level implications of the new census results, remind us, for those of us who it's been a bit since that civics class, remind us what it is that the census is meant to accomplish.
Well, Article 1, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution mandates that every 10 years there be a decennial census to count the population of the United States. And as a direct result, your apportionment for Congress, the House of Representatives, depends upon that, and states make their decisions for legislative districts upon that. But I think it's very important to remember that the census is much more than just about elections. It's about how almost $1 trillion in federal government spending is spent every year in the United States. There are over 316 federal programs that depend upon the calculations that are made by the census account. I think one of the things that's important, getting back to the elections issue, is that there's always an issue, is it an accurate count?
Right.
And to give you an idea, you know, seven states lost congressional seats this year, and six states gained. New York lost one of its congressional seats. If it had had 89 more people counted this year in the 2020 census, they would have maintained their seat, and Minnesota would have lost a seat. But because there were 89 people short of the formula, Minnesota keeps their seats, and New York loses one of those seats.
Wow, just by 89 seats. I don't think I knew that.
89 people. 89 people counted in 2020, yes.
Wow. So I had a friend ask me earlier, kind of watching the news coverage of this, and a little bit of tut-tutting and saying, wow, South Dakota, we're closing in on 1 million people, and yet we still just have that one representative in Congress. And they asked me, what's it going to take for us to gain that seat? And I didn't have an answer for them. Do you? Can you help me untie that one?
Well, it is the, you know, South Dakota had two congressional seats up until with the 1980 census, and we lost one of those seats in 1982. Hmm. And we've been a single district state ever since then. There are seven other states that are single district states. Montana, actually, which had been a single district, will gain one seat, so they will get two seats back. But to give you an idea, the population of South Dakota increased 8.9%. under the census count from 2010 to 2020. We have 886,667 people. Well, the formula is such that the current size, if you divide 435 into 331 million, I think it is, from that standpoint, it's far larger than 886,600 people. It comes out to be somewhere about 1.3 million people it's less than that per congressional seat, but for the South Dakota to get a second seat, it would be my estimation that South Dakota's population would have to grow to be probably 1.2, 1.3 million people. And other states would have to continue to lose population. And of course, that is unless Congress decided to increase the number of congressional seats from 435. And that hasn't happened for a long time. I don't even remember when the 435 was instated. But yeah, so it's a long way. It probably won't occur in my lifetime. If South Dakota continues to grow at 9 to 10% a year, that could have some impact down the long run. But one of the things that you look at also is the fact is the birth rate in the U.S. dropped in the last 10 years. And we've had the smallest growth as a country since the 1930s. It's the second lowest growth rate since they started the census back in 1790, which when the first census was conducted.
Wow. So no gains in seats for South Dakota, no losses in seats either, obviously.
From this year. Guaranteed one. Each state is guaranteed at least one.
Wrap it up for us with this funding piece, because I think it's easy for folks to forget what that piece of the puzzle.
Yes, very much so. I tell you, the one thing that people do forget, like I mentioned earlier, that there's nearly $1 trillion each year that goes to federal programs, and there are 316 plus or more than that federal programs that make determinations as to what the formula would be. To give you an idea, in 2017, the last time that we have complete figures, South Dakota received almost $3.1 billion in formula money. And it runs all the areas. The big share of that, of course, was Medicare. One of the things to pay attention to is Medicaid, where we got almost $1 billion in 2020. And the Medicaid formula is such that smaller states get reimbursed depending on the counts of the people. I'll give you an idea, California and New York receive back only 50% of Medicare reimbursement that the state spends. In 2020, South Dakota got back 62.3%, and the Georgetown University Institute on Public Policy indicates that their studies show that South Dakota would lose between $500 and $1,500 for every individual not counted. That's not just for Medicaid. That's for all formula programs that come to the state, and it includes money that goes to one of the big decisions are we an urban or are we rural? And the definition of urban and rural has a lot of change on how the formulas work. USDA does formula funding. The Department of Education does formula funding, and each one of those federal payouts is based basically on our population. And so as a result, everybody needs to be counted, which is very, very important. And I think that's one of the other things a lot of people don't understand about how important the census count is and what a great fiscal impact it has. And the other thing to remember that the census is just not a 10-year. Every 10 years, they get together and decide to count people. Mm-hmm. Every year, they do the American Community Survey, which includes about 130 different surveys that take all kinds of things into account, besides even counting people, but how different sectors work. And state and local governments depend upon that. Universities that do research depend upon that. And it even breaks down, I would dare say, at SDSU, the Extension Service takes a look at what are the farming practices, what are the ranching practices, because they get those kinds of numbers as a result of the direct result of the agricultural survey that the Census Bureau does every few years.
Our guest has been longtime congressional staff member Chuck Parkinson, helping us unpack those recent census results and what they mean here at home. Chuck, I learned a lot. Thank you for joining us today.
It's always my pleasure, Jackie. Glad to be with you.
This month, we're shining a spotlight on guns in South Dakota. Up next, SDPB's Seth Tupper reviews how gun policies have changed over the years. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear the latest from the former lead trombonist and music director of the Airmen of Note, Ben Patterson. We'll also hear the Airmen of Note with guest soloist Peter Bernstein, guitar. Plus, we'll hear classic tracks from clarinetist and composer Jimmy Giuffre, who was born 100 years ago. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, celebrating 100 years with an all-Beethoven program May 1st in the Washington Pavilion of Sioux Falls. Tickets available at sdsymphony.org.
Hi, this is Carol Johnson. If you made a gift to SDPB during the Sound Vision Drive, my husband Al and I thank you. We were thrilled to offer a matching gift to help SDPB continue its mission. We want SDPB to be all that it can be for South Dakota. Haven't made a gift yet? There is still time to give. Please go online at sdpb.org/donate. Thank you very much.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility, advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. For this month's SDPB Spotlight on guns in South Dakota, we've been exploring our relationship with guns, gun safety, and gun regulations. Today, we look at the politics and policies of the state. SDPB's Seth Tupper joins us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio with a look at how increasing political polarization has changed the debate here at home. Seth, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jackie.
Yeah, political polarization. Go figure, that would have an impact on anything. So I think a lot of us would look at South Dakota and the United States history and just kind of that heritage of that gun-owning, Second Amendment, Wild West kind of idea comes to mind. But some of your past reporting shows us that we actually have more of a history of gun restrictions that was supported on a bipartisan basis here in South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about what you found in that history.
Yeah, in my past reporting, I've taken a couple of deep dives into a couple of issues specifically where we seem to have bipartisan consensus on some gun restrictions that has since fallen apart. And one example of that is the way our state's attitudes and laws have changed in regard to concealed weapons. So when I went back and did the research on this a couple of years ago, I found out that basically for 155 years, the carrying of concealed weapons in Dakota Territory and then South Dakota was either banned or allowed only with a permit. So it's not until we just got rid of that permit requirement a couple of years ago. And The history of this all goes back to the winter of 1864-65, and that was the year when the territorial legislature passed an outright ban on concealed weapons, meaning you were just forbidden to carry concealed weapons at all.
Wow.
And that was part of a nationwide trend in response to gun violence, where all but a handful of U.S. states had outlawed concealed weapons by about 1900. And there was kind of a widely held opinion among some people that carrying a concealed weapon rather than an open weapon was somehow inherently suspicious. Mm-hmm. And there was plenty of evidence of that in the newspapers of the day. You think about Deadwood, for example, in 1879, guns were the cause of a lot of violence. And that year, the Black Hills Daily Times newspaper editorialized that carrying concealed weapons was a, quote, barbarous and unlawful practice. The Daily Deadwood Pioneer Times, I found another editorial there where that paper said the carrying of concealed weapons is not suited to an enlightened people and promotes neither good order in the community nor courage in the individual. And there's the Black Hills Daily Times, and another editorial came on the strongest, and this was, I love some of this old newspaper writing just for the language, but there's also obviously a message here. Yeah. They said, quote, "Let the strong social condemnation of our people make this practice infamous. Let education quicken the public conscience. Let the pulpit do its duty against this unchristian habit. Let the press fearlessly speak its powerful reprobation, that our officers shall feel justified in suppressing this uncivilized and ferocious custom."
These are some really strong words that are kind of surprising. I think I know that kind of bucks my stereotype of that period in history for sure.
Absolutely. And again, it's because, you know, at that time, somebody carrying a concealed weapon into a town like Deadwood was could be trouble, obviously. Mm. And so, you know, that ban, that outright ban on carrying concealed weapons lasted throughout the late 1800s when we became a state and into the early 1900s. And there were often stories in newspapers about arrests and convictions for this crime of carrying a concealed weapon when people got caught doing it. And so the crime was a misdemeanor up until 1917. And then that year, the South Dakota legislature actually increased it to a felony. And that change was signed into law by Governor Peter Norbeck, who was a Republican.
Wow. So we're talking about 100 years of history here, and a lot can happen in that time, as we can see by where we are now. What kind of spurred some of those changes to completely banning concealed weapons to now to allowing them then with a permit?
Yeah, so it appears that a lot of the change started in the Prohibition era in the 1920s and 30s. There was bootlegging of alcohol, and there were gangs, and there was a surge in gun violence all across the country, and that got a lot of attention in the press and the media. So there were some popular calls to ban handguns altogether. Hmm. And the National Rifle Association, which to that point hadn't done much to resist gun control laws, actually mobilized to promote this model legislation as an alternative to banning handguns. And that model legislation allowed people to carry concealed handguns, but said they'd have to get a permit to do it.
Hmm.
And so South Dakota comes along apparently following that lead of the NRA a little bit and passes legislation in 1935 that says, okay, we're not banning the carrying of concealed weapons anymore. We're going to allow people to carry them, but you're going to have a permit, and you're going to have to meet certain qualifications. In other words, we're going to have to know that you're safe to carry a concealed weapon and you're not a threat to society. And it was a Democratic governor, Tom Barry, that signed that bill into law.
Interesting.
And that basically remained the law all the way up into 2019 with some chipping away at it. There were people more on the right side of the political spectrum that wanted to chip away at that and make it easier to carry a concealed weapon. And so there were a lot of modifications passed over the years. But then when the changes really started to happen was when the nation's attention in recent years started turning to all these mass shootings that we've unfortunately had. Mm. And there were calls for greater gun restrictions. Well, in South Dakota, there was a backlash against those calls in the South Dakota legislature. So in 2019, legislators and Governor Kristi Noem repealed the requirement to have a permit for a concealed weapon. So, in other words, for the first time in 155 years, at that point, people in South Dakota were now free to conceal weapons on themselves without any restriction, without it being illegal or without needing a permit.
Hmm.
And in testimony supporting that repeal, legislator Brock Greenfield said this.
We're not trying to create a situation in which South Dakota is the Wild West. We're simply trying to create a situation in which we recognize that the Second Amendment is paramount and will not be infringed.
And there's that Wild West reference again.
Yeah, and that's the irony, and one of the reasons I picked that quote is because, when I went back and did the research after I'd heard him say that in the legislature, if you really go back to the Wild West, you find that, you know, there was a commonly held opinion among a lot of people that it was necessary to ban concealed weapons at that time to protect public safety. They viewed concealed weapons, a lot of people back then, as sort of a menace in society. And there was also testimony, quite a bit of it, against repealing the concealed carry permit requirement. Some especially emotional testimony came from Lisa Lynnett Carroll of Eagle Butte. She said the qualifications that were required to get a concealed carry permit were important to her because she felt like it helped prevent the wrong people from carrying concealed guns.
My own experience with gun violence has never left me. Once you feel that cold, hard barrel against your skin and you realize that the person holding it has, at that moment, full and complete control of whether or not you will live in the next few minutes, you truly realize the power of firearms and that you are at the mercy and discretion of those who hold them. I think it's critical to do our best to ensure that those who hold guns are not criminals or prone to violent actions.
And again, that bill did pass. You no longer need a permit to carry a concealed weapon in South Dakota. Seth, I'm curious between this concealed carry in general and then versus being able to bring guns into publicly accessible places. What are some of the differing attitudes you've seen between those two topics and what else have you learned there?
Yeah, and so these two things kind of played out at the same time in the legislature a couple of years ago, not only the repeal of the concealed carry requirement, which is sometimes called constitutional carry, but also this idea that, you know, we'd been banning guns in some places for a long time, but maybe we should loosen that up. And so although this kind of seems inconceivable now, considering the politics around guns, in 1993, the South Dakota legislature actually voted to ban guns in the state capitol and some county courthouses, and that had support from both Democrats and Republicans. And what had happened was there'd been several violent incidents in county courthouses around the state. So an assistant state's attorney in Minnehaha County drafted a county courthouse gun ban, took it to the legislature. And that was amended during the legislative process to include a ban on guns in the state capitol. Hmm. It also allowed counties to opt out of the courthouse gun ban if they wanted to at the vote of their commission. But anyway, this bill banning guns in the capitol and banning guns in county courthouses passed 26-9 in the Senate and 49-21 in the House. And the numbers were such that it could not have passed without the Republican support it received. And one of the fascinating things about that is if you go back and look at those votes, there were some really notable Republicans at the time who voted for this bill. Hmm. Examples include Mike Rounds, who was a legislator then, went on to serve as governor and a U.S. senator. Christy Feagin, who went on to serve on the Public Utilities Commission. Carol Hillard, who went on to serve as lieutenant governor. And Dave Munson, who went on to serve as mayor of Sioux Falls. These were all Republican legislators at the time who voted in favor of banning guns in the Capitol and banning guns in county courthouses.
Interesting. And I recall hearing that isn't even necessarily the case in the state capitol anymore. Guns aren't totally banned in the state capitol. What changed from the early 90s?
Well, so again, you know, things changed in society in 1999. Again, that law passed in 1993. Then in 1999, we have the Columbine school shooting in Colorado. Mm-hmm. We have all the mass shootings since then and all the political debates about the proper place of guns in society. So the debate really got more divisive. That also happened in South Dakota. There's a group here called South Dakota Gun Owners, for example, which has a political action committee. And that group has funded political postcards that they send to voters where They condemn legislators as anti-gun or anti-Second Amendment if they vote for things like a ban on guns in courthouses or a ban on guns in the Capitol, or if they vote against repealing those things. And this is a group, for example, that on its website calls itself a, quote, no-compromise gun rights organization. And so besides that, there's also a lot of legislators who just feel like the Second Amendment is being threatened. And some of the discussion that we're having in the country today, the right to bear arms. And some legislators in recent years thought, you know, they'd be safer if they could carry guns in the Capitol. And one of those was Betty Olson, who I interviewed a few years ago.
If you're a legislator and you're sitting down there on the floor and you're an open target for anybody that's up on the third floor, walking around, and they can just go right ahead and shoot you.
So, Betty Olson supported that. Lots of other legislators supported opening up the Capitol to allow certain people to carry firearms in. And that happened a couple of years ago when legislators and Governor Noem repealed the ban on guns in the Capitol. And not just anybody can carry guns in there, but if you submit to a background check and complete a course in handgun training, pay some fees, and you give 24 hours notice when you're going to carry in the Capitol, you are allowed to carry in the Capitol now. And so that set up sort of an interesting situation where it used to be that nobody could carry guns in the Capitol. And also, nobody ever got screened to see if they were carrying.
Right.
And now you can carry guns in the Capitol, but now they've also set up a screening checkpoint, and everybody is screened. And so that's an example, I guess, of some of the ways that our attitudes have changed over the years and the complicating factors of this debate.
Mm-hmm. And I feel I've been hearing some more about guns in courthouses recently. What are some updates on that scenario?
So, yeah, as I mentioned previously, guns are basically banned in county courthouses, but local county commissions can opt out of that ban. And in recent years, some have tried to do that, but there have been problems because in a lot of especially rural and smaller counties, the county officials like the treasurers and auditors and those offices share space with courthouse officials or court officials. And although some of the county officials and employees and residents want to be able to carry guns in the county courthouse, a lot of court officials don't feel that safe in a courthouse setting. So we recently heard on In the Moment, Chief Justice Stephen Jensen of the South Dakota Supreme Court, he's working through some of those issues right now, trying to figure out how do they honor the Second Amendment and allow, you know, people to carry in courthouses if a county chooses to do that, yet also keep their courthouse employees safe in an environment where in emotional court proceedings, you don't typically want firearms introduced into that setting.
An interesting history. SDPB's Seth Tupper reviewing the evolution of gun policy in South Dakota as part of this month's SDPB Spotlight. You can find all of our coverage on our monthly topic on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. Seth, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome.
Western South Dakota will see highs in the mid to upper 60s on Thursday and Friday. You might not be thinking about hockey when it'll be near 80 on Saturday and 75 on Sunday, but the Rapid City Rush are in action. South Dakota's top-level minor league team is hosting two promotional nights for the first time ever. Saturday's game against the Kansas City Mavericks is Kentucky Derby night, featuring a pregame, pre-race party. Then Sunday is Racing Day, honoring the more than 50 years history of racing in the Black Hills, with a pregame car show that starts at noon. For tickets and more information, head to RapidCityRush.com. Catch the music of the American Patchwork Quartet Thursday night at 7:30 at the Matthews Opera House in Spearfish. Guitarist and vocalist Clay Ross joins us on In the Moment in about 10 minutes. The Second Opinion Band plays 50s, 60s, and 70s rock and roll along with their originals Friday night in the ReliaBank Theater at the Goss Opera House in Watertown. Showtime is 7 p.m. Partly sunny with highs in the upper 60s the day of the show, then mid-70s for the Northeast on Saturday. Lower 60s will greet those attending the Grow Smarter Conference at the Old Courthouse Museum in Sioux Falls tomorrow and Thursday. That's hosted by the Sioux Metro Growth Alliance. The conference looks to support economic development leaders through networking and educational opportunities with peers. Registration for this inaugural event is limited to 50 people. Learn more at SiouxFallsDevelopment.com. By the way, those highs in the southeastern part of the state will get into the mid-80s on Saturday and mid-70s on Sunday, with no precipitation expected until Monday. Be sure to visit SDPB's events calendar for much more happening in our state. That's sdpb.org. Coming up next, a conversation with South Dakota's Leopold Conservation Award winners for 2021. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. When William Jones III started running in Charlottesville, there was a kind of runner he didn't see.
I don't see black people. And so if I knew that I didn't see it, I knew that my people who needed to see it also weren't seeing it. And so I tried to be it.
Now he heads up one of the most diverse running clubs in town, next time, Here and Now. This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
What do you do with the pieces of a broken heart?
We ask the big questions. And sometimes we even answer them. I'm Larry Gross. Join us each week for Mountain Stage, live performance radio from NPR.
Listen Saturday evening at 6, 5 Mountain, and Sundays at noon, 11 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Leopold Conservation Award is given in honor of renowned conservationist Aldo Leopold. It recognizes private landowners who inspire others with their dedication to the land, water, and wildlife resources in their care. In conjunction with Earth Day, Governor Kristi Noem and the South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources announced that Prairie Paradise Farms near Fort Pierre is this year's recipient. Levi and Crystal Newharth operate Prairie Paradise Farms, and they join us today by phone with more. Levi Newharth, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Crystal Newharth, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, first of all, congratulations to you both on being named this year's recipients. Levi, maybe let's start with you. Just give us a brief introduction for listeners about Prairie Paradise Farms.
Yeah, we operate about 2,300 acres of farm ground and 3,000 acres of grass. And we've been no-tilling for 26 years now, and we've been rotational grazing for over 10 years. And so we custom graze cattle on our crop, on our grasslands, and we have various crop rotations. We don't have a set crop rotation, but some of our main ones are milo, corn, winter wheat, spring wheat, oats. We grow some lentils and peas and some teff once in a while. We do use full season covers, and we do plant some cover crops after winter wheat.
Crystal, I know Prairie Paradise Farms has a motto, and that's healthy land, healthy animals, healthy families. Tell us about your passion for this work that you do with Levi.
This is, being in agriculture, it can just be such a rewarding experience, especially to experience it as a family. And when we can get our natural resources healthy and our landscape healthy, it creates a healthy environment to raise a family and to have livestock and to help educate others and bring awareness to youth and help them learn where their food comes from. And it's just kind of beautiful harmony having all of it together.
Yeah. And speaking of families, I know you typically host a family day in May. I'm not sure which one of you wants to tell us a bit about what that day entails and if it's still on for this year.
Yes, we are still on for this year. We have four educational stations in the morning. We're going to have a safety station and a soil layer station where we learn about the different layers of soil and what's involved in each layer. We're going to have a living root station, and we're going to have the family's pot plants to take home. And then we will also have a soil scientist out here teaching us more about infiltration and that aspect of the soil health. And then in the afternoon, we'll have animal stations where we learn about the chickens and the goats that we have here on the farm. It's just a great experience for families to experience it as a whole together. Instead of just kids going on field trips, they can bring mom or grandma or dad, whoever, and come experience farm life for the day.
Levi, I understand you're a founding member of South Dakota Soil Health Coalition. Tell us how your involvement with that organization kind of influences your philosophy for how you run your farm.
Yeah, I've been involved since the beginning of the Soil Health Coalition, and it's a group of operators that are on the board. We all own our land, and so it's fun bouncing ideas off of each other. And the last year and this year, I have been the chairman, and it's been kind of interesting running it through Zoom with the whole COVID thing, but we're soon to try to have some in-person meetings again, and so we can get together and visit and all that. But yeah, we really like to use the five principles when we're trying to do stuff on our landscape, make sure we keep the ground covered, minimal soil disturbance, integrate livestock, diversity, and keeping the ground covered are all really big keys in our operation.
Tell us about the first thought in your mind when you realized you'd been awarded this conservation award, Levi. Was this an award that was on your radar previous to this announcement?
Ever since the award had come out, it had been a goal of ours to win the award. And when we got the phone call that we won the award, it just kind of gives a guy chills, and very humbling and honored to win the award.
Yeah. Crystal, what was your reaction?
Very similar. We were kind of speechless to know that we are making a difference, and we want to keep making a difference in the future and make our operation more sustainable and spread the message and help other people learn the importance of agriculture and of soil health.
The Leopold Conservation Award is presented annually by Sand County Foundation, the South Dakota Cattlemen's Association, and the South Dakota Grassland Coalition. Prairie Paradise Farms will receive this year's award on December 1st in Rapid City. That's in conjunction with the South Dakota Cattlemen's Association's annual convention and trade show. Our guests have been Prairie Paradise Farm operators Levi and Crystal Newharth. Again, congratulations to both of you. Levi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Crystal, thanks to you as well.
Yes, thank you. Have a great day.
The Matthews Opera House in Spearfish is opening their new live music series with the American Patchwork Quartet. That's this Thursday night at 7:30. We're joined now by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and vocalist Clay Ross. Clay was a founding member of the South Carolina group Ranky Tanky. He's toured worldwide as cultural ambassador through the U.S. State Department and will be part of the show on Thursday night. Clay Ross, welcome to In the Moment. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Really happy to be here.
So, American Patchwork Quartet. Tell us just about this name and how it connects with really the mission of the music that you're creating with these fellow players.
Yeah, so American Patchwork Quartet was born out of a collaboration with my teaching partner at Carnegie Hall. I've been a teaching artist in residence. When I'm not touring, I teach at Carnegie Hall in New York City, and I've been really honored to get to know a fellow musician by the name of Falu Shaw. And Falu was born in Mumbai, India, and we've had a lot of opportunity to just connect, writing songs for expectant mothers and doing community outreach work through Carnegie. And in the time that we were together, you know, we really wanted to collaborate. We wanted to figure out a way to make music together and to perform together, because she is a magnificent vocalist and an incredible performer. And, you know, we were trying to think about, you know, what connects us as artists and where the common ground is. And I'm really interested in roots music. As your announcement and introduction mentioned, I'm, you know, a founding member of the group Ranky Tanky, and we explored Southern roots music of the Gullah tradition. And while I was doing research for that project, I came across a lot of American folk songs from Appalachian traditions and other regional traditions, not specifically Gullah, that I really loved and I felt I would love to perform. And I brought them to Falu, and she loved the songs as well. And we felt like the thing that connected us is our Americanness. We are both American citizens, even though she recently immigrated from Mumbai, and I've been here all my life. My Scottish ancestors, you know, came to this country hundreds of years ago to start anew. And all the members of American Patchwork Quartet come from a diverse background. Our drummer, Clarence Penn, is a phenomenal three-time Grammy-winning jazz drummer that was born in Detroit, Michigan, but his ancestral roots are in Nigeria. Our bassist, Yasushi Nakamura, is an award-winning jazz bassist who actually immigrated here 20 years ago from Tokyo, Japan. So the idea that America is a patchwork of culture and of people is what we aim to celebrate through these timeless American folk songs that tell a story about immigration and the human condition throughout American history.
There's a quote on in a kind of an introductory video about this group on your website that says American music is a process and not a product, which I find to be such an interesting thought. Tell us how working with these other musicians and kind of reclaiming that patchwork nature of the American story into your music, that process versus a product mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I think the American music has been packaged, right? All the labels that we think of that we associate with different styles of music, be it rap and hip hop or country music or rock and roll, you know, these are all labels that were just created by marketers to sell music. And that started all the way back in the early 1900s, at the dawn of the recording age, when music started to be recorded for the first time. And the only types of records that were sold initially were either called hillbilly records or race records. And they were segregated along color lines as black, you know, these are records for black people and these are records for white people. And it was really that simple. And meanwhile, a lot of the songs and a lot of the actual musical influences were similar across those lines. So we're just seeking to sort of reclaim that identity that this music and our American process has always been a collaborative process. And it's always, the music has always transcended color and racial lines. And always the most special offering that America has for the world is that the musics that have come from our country, be it jazz or blues or bluegrass or folk, you know, they all come from this mixture of different cultures, and they imbibe and they use all the influences from all kinds of different people, from all the immigrants and native peoples that were a part of this land. So, you know, when you hear American Patchwork Quartet, you're going to hear country music. You're going to hear jazz music. You're going to hear blues music. You're going to hear all these things that sound familiar to you that might be easy to sort of qualify as one genre or another, but it's the common thread is that it's all American. It's all American music.
In our final about minute or so together, Clay, I want to ask you, as we're starting to see the return of live music events more in earnest, how is returning to traveling and performing, putting that process into perspective for you as a musician. And I will say, I am a bit biased, but I think traveling to the western part of South Dakota and putting on a show in Spearfish is a great place to kind of start the return to that live touring performing. Tell us what this means for you.
I got to be honest. You know, we had probably 15 performances planned for this season that were all moved or canceled because of COVID. And we were really heartbroken, and I know all of us were for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But for us specifically, we are so excited about this show because this will be our first public performance since COVID.
Hmm.
So this is a coming out for us. We're so excited. We couldn't be more excited to share it in a beautiful place like Spearfish. I've been to the theater twice. I was with my group Matuto first, and then I came again with, actually, I think this is my fourth time because I think I played with an artist named April Birch, and then I played with Matuto, and then I played with Ranky Tanky, and now we're going to do American Patchwork Quartet, and I really just couldn't be more excited about it. We're all really have missed live audiences, and we're so looking forward to connect with people. I'm totally vaccinated and ready to say hey. So it's really a good time.
Good. Our guest has been Clay Ross. He's part of the group American Patchwork Quartet. They're playing the Matthews Opera House this Thursday night at 7:30. For updates on COVID restrictions, you can visit matthewsoperahouse.com. Clay Ross, thanks so much for joining us on In the Moment, and we're excited to have you back in South Dakota playing live.
Can't wait to see you all. Thank you so much.
We're going to close out our hour with the song Pretty Sero from the American Patchwork Quartet. And that's going to close out our show. Thanks to all of our guests. On tomorrow's show, SDPB's Nate Weck joins us for a preview of the NFL draft and the story of an athlete from Pine Ridge awaiting the possibility of a national football career. Here and Now is coming up next. I'm Jackie Hendry in for Lori Walsh from all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening. Sarah's window.